Welcome to Plastisphere, the podcast on plastic, people, and the planet. My name is Anja Krieger. As I record this, the INC4, the fourth round of negotiations for the Plastics Treaty, is in the final hours. Negotiators of countries around the world are sitting in conference rooms in Ottawa, Canada, debating how to end plastic pollution. Around them, the presence of the fossil and chemical industries has grown significantly. Compared to the last meeting in Nairobi, 37% more lobbyists are attending. They outnumber many other groups, such as the delegates of the European countries, or the smallest 87 countries combined. The effort to quantify this lobby presence was led by CIEL, the Center for International Environmental Law. In a press conference that you'll now hear, the NGO brought together speakers from Greenpeace, the Scientists Coalition for an Effective Plastics Treaty, and the Indigenous Peoples Caucus. It's a very impressive hour, so I wanted to share it with you. For context, one of the First Nations in Canada just had to declare a state of emergency. A plastics plant in their vicinity had released chemicals into their environment. This is just one of the incidents that points to the burden frontline communities living close to production and disposal facilities are carrying around the world. So environmental justice is a huge issue when it comes to plastic pollution. Let's hear more from the panel.
We are going to start, so if you can take your seats. And as it is not my land, I will hand over to the right holders of this land to welcome us in this space.
Bonjour, Anin, Nianadejnikosh, Ginukwe, Makwadodem, Alderville Donjaba, speaking in the sovereign language of this traditional territory. We are on the unceded stolen lands of the Anishinaabe Algonquin territories. My name is Ginukwe, Golden Eagle Woman. I sit with the Bear Clan and Medicine Clan from Alderville Donjaba, Williams Treaty Territory, and we would like to welcome each and every one of you and all of the guests here at INC into our traditional homelands. I want to acknowledge that we are meeting on this land that has been inhabited by Indigenous peoples from the beginning of time. We want to acknowledge the impact colonization, oppression, and violence of all forms has, aimed particularly at Indigenous and Black peoples. We ask that newcomers are grateful for the opportunity to meet here, and we thank all the generations of people who have taken care of this land and its waters for thousands of years. As we are all treaty people, learning about the land you stand on, the people whose home here is vital. We recognize and deeply appreciate our historic connections to this place. We recognize the contributions of our Métis and Inuit brothers and sisters and all the other Indigenous people, both in shaping and strengthening this community in particular, and all the teachings we learn in nation-to-nation relationships. We also want to recognize the terrible impacts of colonization on Indigenous African peoples, many of whom were brought by colonizers to this territory, and while also settlers arrived here against their will as slaves. The historic legacy of racist white supremacy continues today and must inform our commitment to end oppression of all kinds and challenges and challenge the colonial power systems that create and maintain it. We must work together and with our allies, and we must be clearly and overtly connected to our collective commitment to make the promise and challenge of truth and reconciliation real in our communities. And we must do this with our actions, not simply our words. Tibnahal. So with that, I want to acknowledge the tobacco ties that we have placed on the tables. This tobacco is our first traditional medicine, our plant medicine, that's given to us by Creator. And these tobacco ties are our prayers, and they're our prayers for Mother Earth. And when we come and speak with our relatives and we welcome people into our territories, when we approach an elder, when we go and gather our medicines, anything we take, we offer something in return. And so before I go pick our plant medicines, before I go reach out to an elder, I would offer this traditional sema, this tobacco. And it's a reminder that we are all human nation, that we are gathered spirit to spirit, and it is our role and responsibility to protect Mother Earth. And as I look at this tobacco, and this is natural plant tobacco, not to be confused with cigarette tobacco, because understanding that there's over 600 chemicals in cigarette tobacco that people are smoking and ingesting, and when we take those medicines and we use them in a bad way, when we harm them, when we mutate them with chemicals and all of those different things, then it becomes very harmful to us. So even in our traditional tobacco, as a knowledge keeper and elder, when people in the community offer me sema, I go to my own sema. I go to the plant tobacco tobacco that I have grown that is not covered in chemicals, because it's making us sick as elders and traditional people. We notice the change when someone gives us traditional tobacco versus chemical tobacco. Sometimes we'll accept all the tobacco and we'll go put it to the earth, or we'll pray with it, but we won't ingest it. We won't take that. We don't smoke this tobacco. It's a gift and an honoring. So with that, I just wanted to share that teaching of our medicines and really realizing the far-reaching impacts of the chemical industry within our own medicines. I would also like to invite my niece, Clarity Smoke, to welcome each and every one of you with an honor song.
Ani bojo, Clarity Smoke, Jaganash Shinikade, Makwa Minwa, Megazan Dodam, Bertelsu First Nation, Ndan Dabendagos, Alderville Megwan Dada. Anishinaabe minwa yate kwe nda. Minuwen dam nonga, nui nagamo naken moe, chimigwech mau zonwak. Nui nagamo nandwi ndwa. Chimigwech kijem nado nda gamo. I wanted to say chimigwech for giving me the opportunity to open this press conference with a song. It is crucial for us to be able to express ourselves as Indigenous people, whether that be through speech, prayer, song, or dance. We deserve to have this space and to be in spaces that are made to silence us from taking care of what we admire and respect the most: the land, our culture, our language. I will sing this song in honor of the work that is being done for our land, for the seven generations before us and the seven generations after us. Miigwech.
Oh, gonna. We are here to share the space. We say Chimigwach for the invite. And again, just really understanding that we as the Indigenous people, we want to remind everyone during the INC4 treaty negotiations that they must ensure Indigenous people's rights are uplifted, we are centered, and our expertise and our traditional ecological knowledge are embedded within the Global Plastics Treaty. This treaty must ensure that any proposed solutions for just transition lead with the security protection and the safeguards for human health and the environment in the most marginalized communities, which is our Indigenous and Black communities. And we say Chimigwach Tipnahau, it has been said. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Susan, Clarity, and Tori, for opening this space for us and welcoming us on your land. My name is Delphine Levy-Alvarez. I'm Global Petrochemicals Manager at the Center for International Environmental Law. And I also have the pleasure to coordinate the Global Petrochemicals Campaign of the Break Free from Plastic Movement. And late in the night, we finished analyzing the participants list to this INC4. This is the list of people who registered to INC4. We found that there were 196 lobbies from the chemical and fossil fuel industry registered to these talks. We are not counting other type of industry lobbyists, so there is more, but we have isolated the ones from the fossil fuel and chemical companies as much as possible, depending on how open and transparent they've been about their affiliation at registration, because companies are not accredited as such. People are registered through NGOs, business associations, country delegations, a lot of different places. Compared to INC3, it's a 37% increase in the number of industry lobbyists from the fossil fuel and chemical industry registered to these talks. We have found very interesting numbers around how much that compares to a number of other delegations. There are more NGOs than industry lobbyists registered. The conversation is not about the number. The conversation is about the influence and the access that people have to delegates, to funding, to organize lobbying events that are either public or behind closed doors. And so we are not here to contest whatever is on this paper that you may or may not have received from someone from the American Chemistry Council at the entrance of this room. We are not contesting that we are more, but we are here to represent the public interest, the interest of Mother Earth. We are legitimate stakeholders in this space. We are not the ones who have created the problems. We are the ones who are trying to solve it. So the conversation is not on numbers. It's on influence. I just wanted to state that clearly, in case it wasn't clear. One thing that is, there are many things interesting in this analysis, and I will not just state out all the numbers just to state them out. I will start with one striking calculation that I made, not by head, because I'm not that good at math, but we have 28 representatives of Indigenous peoples in the Indigenous Peoples Caucus in this space. This is 7 times less than the fossil fuel and chemical industry lobbyists registered on the list. And so I want to turn to Susan and ask her, what do you think about that, Susan?
In these negotiations, it is troubling that industry and those responsible for polluting are part of the negotiating, influencing the outcomes of these talks. This is a direct conflict of interest and excludes the spaces for Indigenous rights holders and the sovereign peoples. By having industry welcomed into these spaces while excluding the voices of our knowledge keepers is part of a continued genocide. And some of the players here that are pushing for the plastic circularity at INC4, those are our people in our communities that are dying from pollution. These are where the pipelines and the extraction is happening that's poisoning our communities and the high rates of cancer, miscarriages. It's our communities, and the time is now. When people say that we need more time to discuss, we need more time at the tables, when we have people that are benefiting from the deaths of our people while they're excluding us in these spaces. Again, it is a continued genocide. We call it ecocide in our communities. And for us to be here today and throughout the week, we are raising our voices in truth and in sovereignty, and that is our true power as Indigenous people. We are the rights holders, and INC4 and all of the negotiations have to uphold UNDRIP, which is the free, prior, and informed consent of all the people in our lands and territories. The Shaw Center sits within the Algonquin Anishinaabe territories, but the scope of these negotiations don't only affect Kitigan Zibi, they affect all of us, 633 distinct nations across Canada and across Turtle Island, because there is no border for us as Indigenous people. That border crossed us.
Thank you so much, Susan. And so we also have Bethany Carney Amrath. She's a professor of ecotoxicology at the University of Gothenburg and a proud member of the Scientist Coalition for an Effective Plastic Treaty. And the analysis that Sial realized with the support of many partners shows that there are 58 scientists in this coalition represented here versus 193 industry lobbies from the chemical and fossil fuel industry. I'm not so good with math again, but it's almost three times more. It's actually more than three times more. And industry has been also producing science and informing delegates with some reports and briefings with numbers that are coming from their access to data. So I want to turn to Bethany to talk about independent science and also how have scientists been welcomed in this space.
Okay, thank you. As you heard, I'm a professor of ecotoxicology in Sweden, and I work on plastics, pollution, and chemicals in plastics, their effects in the environment. And I'm also very active in the science policy space where we are right now. Some of my work has also been looking at exactly that space and how science is communicated and used in supporting policy action. And what we find, and this is not a news story, there are commonly used techniques that are employed by industry and actors with conflicts of interest to delay or block policy action. And this includes things like providing misinformation or misrepresenting science, cherry-picking data, providing false experts, by lifting certain questions and not providing a holistic and systemic understanding of the impacts of, in this case, plastics in the environment. This is something that, as I already said, have published peer-reviewed scientific papers on, as well as policy briefs relevant to this process. And our scientists, myself included, do experience harassment in this space. This is another technique that is used to undermine our credibility. So they not only provide their own data, science, information, as you may call it, they also try to undermine that of independent academic scientists, trying to pull apart our research, trying to accuse us of not reaching standards that they are posing upon us. And when they can't undermine our science, they try to attack us personally. And this is done in a number of different ways. I have been accused of stepping outside of my role in society beyond academia into this space. I've been accused of being wrong in communicating science to policymakers and to the public. I've been accused of fear-mongering and of misinformation in reporting what my own peer-reviewed scientific results show. And this is a way to try to silence us and undermine us, because our science does not support the positions they are taking in here. We need to take into account robust, independent science and knowledge from traditional knowledge holders and Indigenous peoples to inform this process. The actors that are in this space with these vested interests and conflicts of interest are undermining that, and they're undermining our ability to find an ambitious treaty that can truly protect people and the planet.
Thank you so much, Bethany. I will go to you, Yun, for the next interesting data. So again, what we can analyze depends on what people disclose when they register. What we found from what they disclosed was that there were 16 lobbies from the fossil fuel and chemical industry in country delegations. So going around with a red badge representing a country, being able to sit at the negotiation table, having access to conversations that are happening just amongst delegations behind closed doors. And those delegations that we identified are Malaysia, Thailand, Iran, Dominican Republic, China, Kazakhstan, Kuwait, Turkey, and Uganda. Yuyun is the founder of Nexus 3 Foundation in Indonesia and the convener of the Indonesian Zero Waste Alliance, also steering committee member of Break Free from Plastic and plastic policy advisor for IPEN. She wears many different hats. And she has also published yesterday something that shows a little bit of a difference from our analysis when it comes to the Indonesian delegation.
Thank you, Delphine. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for having me here. The list that you receive from the Secretariat is the provisional list. And when we look at the delegate from our country, Indonesia, we found four names represent, actually they are coming from industry. To be precise, they are from olefins and aromatic industry. We have to spell out olefins and aromatics, because if you say only polymer and monomer, it's not them. They will say it's the other guy, not me. But if we spell out calling them as the aromatic and olefin industry, it's them. So they are registered as experts of the Minister of Industry, delegates of Indonesia. And we understand that some of them also still coming, but not on that list yet. I met one of them yesterday, but I can't see his name on the list. He's wearing the red badge. So this is a follow-up of their lobby at the national level for a couple of years, because Indonesia is just expanding the production of polyethylene, double of the capacity, starting from this year until the next 20 years. And this industry received tax holidays 100% for 20 years. And in the next 20 years, they receive 50% tax holidays. They don't have to pay tax, but we all picking up their crabs. And in this discussion, in this meeting also, we talk about the pollution tax, only the products being taxed, but the producer enjoy tax holidays for 40 years while we are all getting all the crabs and the health effects. This is also a good example of how pollutant and pollutions from plastics, including the chemicals, going transboundary. Indonesia is located in tropical countries. And as we know from the persistent organic pollutants, all the plastic chemicals are also, some of them are persistent organic pollutants that travel far from its source. So our sisters and brothers in Alaska are also affected by this, because all of the toxic chemicals will be deposited in cold climate. So we call this hemispheric sink. So the Alaskan sisters and brothers, which also the place where the oil and gas industry extracted, only enjoy the pollution from the extraction and also receive the pollution from all over the world and also from the products. This is not fair, putting the frontline communities, the right holders, to be out from this treaty, but we welcoming the polluters. It doesn't make sense. So we heard also yesterday that delegates want to delete the word of indigenous people and even add local communities to dilute everything. So we must stand together to highlight this, because the pollution is not only in one place, but it's spread out all over. So if we allow them, the polluters, to sit here and influence delegates, we don't know what's going to happen, but we know what is going to happen in the next 20, 30 years. And I don't want my grandson have a crappy environment. So for those who are interested in attending a press conference, there will be a press lunch and briefing at the University of Ottawa after this. Welcome, and lunch will be provided so we can discuss more about the impact of plastic industry in Alaska and the impact to the indigenous people. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Xuyun. So before I go to our last two speakers, our dear Susan is going to have to leave us in a couple of minutes for another press conference. She's really demanded. So we're very grateful to have her for a couple more minutes. So she's going to share a last few words, and then we'll go to Laura and Graham.
As stated, INC4 must protect our inherent rights and uphold our inherent rights to protect the environment for our future generations, where there is true sustainability and good health. There is no such thing as plastic circularity. It only means more virgin plastic production, which is extraction in our communities, in our backyards of our children's, and in our schools and our families' homes. We will not reach sustainable development goals if we do not address this crisis at all stages, not just the waste management issues. If we do, we will be leaving out our communities that have been disproportionately impacted and sacrificed for generations. As Indigenous people, we want to make it clear that nature-based solutions is Indigenous knowledge and must be protected, and it must be embedded into the framework and language of this treaty. We must ban all chemicals of concern that have already been connected to adverse human health and environmental impacts. We as Indigenous people have and can continue to prove the harm, violence, and disregard to our communities through the historical proof of our old traditional ways of passing this knowledge down from generation to generation. These spaces have been designed to exclude our voices, and if we are going to make true change and real change, we need to recognize it. It is the humanity that has been removed from these discussions. Make sure whatever proposed solutions lead with these approaches first and foremost, because if we do not, we will be moving from one extractive practice to another where it will be a detriment to other communities somewhere else. Just transition should not mean at the detriment of our relatives. The plastic crisis is not about down, mid, and upstream. It is about the whole stream as one large problem on all Indigenous, Brown, and Black communities who have been disproportionately impacted for generations. This crisis starts at extraction to waste, the full death cycle of plastics. We need the treaty to adopt a comprehensive full life cycle of plastics from extraction to waste. We need product reduction goals and real commitments with consequences for those that do not agree or violate all agreements to an ambitious treaty address this crisis with real solutions. We need intersessional work to truly develop an ambitious treaty, and we also need to uplift the real and true reuse systems that lead with Indigenous knowledge, where we are protecting that knowledge at the same time. Microplastics are already in our bodies and in our systems and will be in the bodies of our children and our grandchildren, even despite the changes that are made in this treaty this week. Industry has normalized this harm for so long, and our people are dying and our communities are being harmed. We must not rush this process. We must uphold the inherent rights of the true Indigenous people and make sure that our voices are centered in these treaty negotiations. If INC4 fails to uplift and center our voices, it is a treaty doomed to fail. Miigwech.
Thank you, Susan. All the best for the upcoming lineup of press conferences. Thank you for being with us. I will jump my order and go to Graham Forbes, who leads the Greenpeace delegation in this space. So Graham, Greenpeace work is really to hold companies accountable, right, in this space and advocate for this treaty to do the right thing that just Susan laid out perfectly, which is cutting plastic production and really addressing the problem at the source. In the analysis that we just released, we see that the industry delegation is bigger than the 87 smallest country delegations, which is it's bigger basically from Finland down, and then we also have only 73 representatives from the Pacific small island developing states. So it's more than twice less than the industries. And interesting fact as well, it's a bigger delegation than the EU delegation. So all EU delegates together from the 27 countries who are registered are less than the industry advocating for chemical and fossil fuel interests. So in the work that Greenpeace has done, how do you see the influence of these companies on the position of countries, and maybe more in particular, because that's where you are active in the US policy space?
Thanks, Delphine, and thanks to everyone for having us. Greenpeace is here to work alongside our allies to advocate for a global plastics treaty that massively cuts plastic production. we are calling for a cut to global plastic production of at least 75% by 2040 based on a 2019 baseline. You cannot end plastic pollution if you do not cut plastic production. When we think about the influence of the fossil fuel industry, as we sit here, the industry is investing hundreds of billions of dollars in new petrochemical facilities that will come online, produce toxic plastics for generations to come. We are clearly at unsustainable levels now, and they are putting all their money behind plans to make the problem worse. If you want to understand the industry's strategy and what they're trying to do with their influence, the best, you know, we listen to what they say. An Exxon lobbyist, former Exxon lobbyist, has said on the record 2 years ago that Exxon plans to use its climate playbook in a plastics space, and that's exactly what we've seen. We know that this is a top priority for the American Chemistry Council, who is behind much of the lobbyists that are here and playing a terrible role in undermining our ability to have frank conversations about what everyone knows needs to be done. The ACC specifically, when we look at country positions, in many ways they speak for themselves. If you look at sort of news articles from civil society calling on the US government to do the things that are necessary to cut plastic production, to put in place and talk about global goals, targets, mandatory contributions from countries to reduce the amount of toxic plastics that we're putting into the world. The ACC is very clear that their intention is to use the US government to lead the way towards a treaty that falls short of what the world needs. Their plan is to really use the US government, to rely on the US government to prevent the rest of the world from moving forward to take the action that's required. And so Greenpeace is here alongside our friends and our allies to ensure that doesn't happen. The science is abundantly clear, the moral imperative is abundantly clear, and the fossil fuel industry is really here to ensure that they are able to profit with impunity at the expense of our planet, of indigenous peoples, of frontline communities, and of workers across the entire supply chain, and specifically waste pickers who are responsible for keeping this entire system from collapsing entirely. And we are going to stand, and we encourage all of you to join us to ensure that the fossil fuel industry does not lock us into their disastrous, poisonous vision of the future so that they can make short-term profits.
Thank you, Graham. So we are here talking about corporate capture or potential corporate capture of the negotiations. We're here to talk about conflict of interest, the interests that are driven by money, by profits, over the interest of people and the planet. And there has been calls from civil society and right holders to really enforce strong conflict of interest policy in the negotiation space leading to the adoption of the treaty and within the treaty space once it's negotiated, so that we can ensure what Graham and all other panelists so far have discussed, a treaty that really addresses the problem and is not just a massive waste of time and money, especially for those here who are really struggling to find funding to come to these negotiations and find the time to be here, because a lot of people are not paid for their time here. And that's something that is definitely not common with the industry lobbyist. So there is a space in which there's been a lot of work done on conflict of interest. It's the tobacco control space. And we have Laura Salgado, who's head of campaign and partnership at the Global Center for the Good Governance in Tobacco Control. I got that one right today. And a member of the Stop Tobacco Pollution Alliance. And Laura is going to talk to us about the work that has been done in that space. And why are they here? They work on tobacco. Why would they be in the plastic space?
Thank you, Delphine, for the question. Hi, good morning, everyone. It's an important question because we stand at a critical stage of our fight against plastic pollution, a crisis that demands an urgent action and unwavering commitment. And it is imperative that we draw upon the lessons and principles established by the existing treaties, particularly the World Health Organization Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, the FCTC. In this article, 5.3 serves as our ideal integrity, guiding us in our effort to prevent conflict of interest between the governments, United Nations, and the tobacco industry. It underscores the need for a robust measures to shield our policy-making process from undue influence and interference by vested interest. Also, in the last conference of the parties for the FCTC, the governments made an important decision under the Article 18 that is referring to the environment of this treaty to ban cigarette filters, which are made of unnecessary and problematic plastics. As we navigate to these complexities of crafting a plastic pollution treaty, we must remain vigilant against the powerful influence from hidden hands from polluting industry who are present in these negotiations. These industries, driven by profit motivations, employ lobbyists to advocate on their behalf. So, exerting under influence and undermining the integrity of our negotiations. We cannot afford to ignore this reality. So, we urge all the stakeholders to prioritize that transparency and accountability in our treaty negotiations. We must unequivocally exclude representatives of polluting industry from our deliberations and ensure that our treaty language explicitly addresses the influence through conflict of interest. We need to ensure the treaty includes an article or section on addressing conflict of interest. Failure to do so risks diluting the effectiveness of our effort and compromise the integrity of our treaty. Let us stand in our resolve to confront plastic pollution head on, guided by principles of integrity, transparency, and accountability. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Laura. We're reaching the end of our interventions and we'll have actually quite a lot of time for questions. I think Bethany wanted to add something more on the human rights dimension of this discussion.
Yeah, just a quick response before I comment on that to Delphine's comment about funding. And as you said earlier, we are 58 scientists on the ground here. We're all independent academic scientists, and we are not funded. We are volunteering our time and our expertise to be here, and we are all self-funding our travels. So there is definitely a big difference in the amount of resources that we're coming into this space with. But I also wanted to mention, just in closing, that we would like to uplift the human right to science, which is important in this space, the human right to knowledge and information, which includes transparency in reporting around plastics and chemicals. And we would like to uplift the human right to a clean, healthy, and sustainable environment. And science and knowledge and information can help us achieve the goal of a clean, healthy, and sustainable environment. But those rights need to be protected, and they need to be protected in this space as well. Thank you.
And I'll add that I know that for the Scientist Coalition, it includes all sort of science and academic knowledge, and really makes a lot of space for indigenous science and indigenous knowledge that is usually not recognized in those spaces as it should. So just closing with that, I want to acknowledge that this work has been done by two of my colleagues who are not here, so Barnaby Pace and Marie Talaya, who've been instrumental to crunching numbers. So I want to make sure they're acknowledged for their work. We are now going to have time for questions. And I am going to hand over to my fantastic colleague, Kate Bonaccini.
Hello, everybody. Yes, I'm Kate Bonaccini. I'm the Senior Communications Specialist at the Center for International Environmental Law, and I work largely on the Plastics Treaty. We'll send around materials after the press conference. We had a bit of problem with the live stream, but you will have that later. And additional questions can be sent to press@cl.org. That's press@cl.org, and we'll get to them. But for now, let's go ahead and open it for questions. And as people have questions, please introduce yourself with your name and your outlet.
Hi, I'm Steve Tolikin with Plastics News Magazine. Thanks for holding the press conference. I guess I have a two-part question. Is your argument that industry groups should not participate in the talks? Are there specific asks that you're asking of the United Nations or the INC process? I'm just trying to understand. Have you had conversations with the UN agencies about this and trying to understand better the...
Laura, I saw your eyes light up.
Okay. Based on the experience that we had in the negotiation of the tobacco control treaty, the preamble is very clear, saying that the interest of the industry is totally opposite to the industry of the public health. So their interests are commercial, and we are interested to stop this pollution. So it's very clear in the preamble, and we are asking that this treaty also takes in consideration. And we are looking for transparency to see who are negotiating in the table. But we know that some of the industry that knows that they have conflict of interest, they send these lobbyists to negotiate on their behalf. So we are asking for transparency in this process. And if they have a conflict of interest, they should not be part of this, because we want a strong plastic treaty. And if they are part, they will look for less strong measures in order not to lose their interest or their money.
Anyone else? And I just want to say there are two places in which conflict of interest policies could come into play. It's definitely in the INC process, but it's also the treaty itself. And those are two distinct, separate areas for conflict of interest. I saw over here.
Hi, I'm Lisa Song from ProPublica. This is a question for anyone here. Are there any non-industry civil society representatives who are part of any official country delegations?
Yeah, some of our colleagues or NGO or used to be an NGO become the government member of the government delegate as well, but only one in one country. Not massive, like not four, not five. So if the government wanted to have representative of different stakeholders as the member of the delegation, it should be fairly selected in fair numbers and not outnumbered the other non-government stakeholders. And there is also another way of disguising as the member of the delegates. They do not mention their real affiliation, but they were labeled as expert or researcher. That is a common way to register industry or non-government organizations or non-government entity as a government delegate. But we see examples that it's too much. Even when I scroll and search for the words Ministry of Health, I found only three countries have delegates from the Ministry of Health. So I think, of course, it depends on countries' decision who will be in their delegation. But if countries prioritizing health also, they should have had a representative of Ministry of Health as part of the member of delegation.
Bethany?
Yeah, I can comment quickly on academic scientists. In the past, universities have had a very difficult time in gaining access directly to UNEP via the accreditation office because of the requirements defined there. And those are that institutions should be non-academic and non-for-profit, which most universities around the world would be. This is changing, and it has changed in the past year, very much thanks to work of collaboration between myself and colleagues at the International Panel on Chemical Pollution, where we've engaged in dialogues with UNEP and their accreditation office and their lawyers about academic freedom and the separation between state funding for public universities and research. So now there are more universities that have been accredited to UNEP and can attend these processes, so our scientists can join with their real affiliation on their name tags. A lot of the rest of us are joining via other organizations that are generously bringing us into this space. But there are also government delegations that are bringing scientists on board. And there are a number of governments I know that have understood the difficulty for academic scientists to get here and have therefore reached out a hand and brought them into their delegations to help them come here and do the work that we're doing in communicating science.
All right, let's go here.
Judy Trin with CTV National News. I'm wondering, since we are in Canada, and Canada is also a close ally, aligned with the US on many fronts, how much of a mark, a target, or vulnerabilities is Canada to the plastics industry? Like, how much do you know of the lobbyist groups targeting this country in hopes of impacting discussions beyond the ambitious group of countries who want, harder targets by 2040?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to see more leadership from the government of Canada. And I think what we've seen is with the single-use law that was passed in Canada, I believe there was a lawsuit from Dow Chemical. And so you see that many countries are vulnerable to industry pressure. And I think we would expect to see a much more progressive position from the government of Canada, given the Trudeau administration sort of commitment to environmental sustainability, human health, and commitment to Indigenous peoples. And Canada is also a top 10 oil and gas producing nation. And so I think that in many ways is influencing or limiting their ability to take the type of position that would actually help address plastic production, which is the core issue that we need to get at. And so I think from our perspective, the American Chemistry Council is very embedded in the US sort of delegation and administration, but they're also, their influence is certainly global. They understand this is a global issue. And in many ways, I think the fossil fuel industry has played a dominant role in international trade negotiations and in international spaces in a way that's incredibly problematic. And I think there is a business coalition and there is some diversity in the business community where you have almost 200 businesses from the Sustainable Business Coalition or whatever they're calling themselves advocating for production cuts as well. And so I think that's noteworthy. And so I think one of the messages to governments is that, industry is not coming here with a united voice. The fossil fuel industry is uniquely problematic. And so we're hoping that governments are going to start to pay attention to that. And we'd like to see the government of Canada take a much more progressive stance on global target and limits to plastic production, because no other aspect of the treaty can succeed if we continue to produce the amount of plastics that we're producing. I mean, the Scientist Coalition has described this as a fight for the future of humanity. We have, plastic particles in our lungs and our hearts. I mean, it really, the future of a healthy planet for our children is at stake. We need to have a real conversation about real solutions, and that starts at the source, and the fossil fuel industry is limiting those debate in the way that we need to have it.
And I just want to say, industry is not a monolith. We certainly have members of other kinds of industries represented, and if folks want to talk to those individuals after the press conference, just let me know, because I know, folks are definitely having different experiences if industry is in their name. I want to go right over here.
Hi, Emma Howard from Unearthed. Question for Laura, but other people may also have thoughts. Are you able to give any more details about what you would like the UN to do on conflict of interest and why you think they've not been stronger so far?
That the FCTC already have this article that has been implemented, and during the negotiation of the conference of the party for the tobacco control treaty, the industry are not part of that negotiations. And there are other models, and the UN system, also the FENSA, with the WHO that protect the relationship between the governments, WHO, and the industry in general. So what we are asking is to include something in this treaty to protect the treaty and also to protect the process against this kind of industry participation. So there are some models of implementation. So there are some articles or guidelines on conflict of interest. So our goal is that in during this process, they can be also included. I don't know if I ask, respond to that. So they have taken consideration. There are some models, just we ask that in this process to be aware or recognize that there is a problem and the need to do something.
I just want to add maybe in terms of context, why is also this kind of demand being pushed forward beyond the fact that, you know, bringing their science, having the influence that they have. There is also an extreme violence for communities on the front line of the plastic pollution and of the petrochemicals pollution to share a space with the perpetrators of the pollution. We had yesterday a conversation here with the indigenous leaders of this land who were sharing about extreme pollution of their territories by petrochemical and plastic producing companies. Finding yourself in the line to buy a sandwich next to the person who works and makes money from the company that is creating the pollution that is killing your families and your community is of extreme violence. And we need to protect frontline communities and indigenous peoples from this kind of violence, because there is already a lot of violence caused to them. And it's a historical violence that Susan has been also naming in this press conference, but also in other press conferences.
We have time for one more.
Hi, my name is Martin Bork. I'm with the Alliance of Mission-Based Recyclers, and we represent the original curbside recyclers in the United States. We've been tremendously harmed by plastic packaging as an industry, both operationally and reputationally, to the point where recycling is now kind of a bad word. And when these perspectives are brought into the industry listening group for the US State Department, the US delegation, we were asked to leave that and later removed from those meetings. And I'm wondering if you're hearing similar kinds of things in other delegations and how that fits into some of the other perspectives that you have or are seeing otherwise. Thank you.
Does anyone want to take that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I just want to comment. I think that's a really important point that Martin's making. And again, I think it goes back to the diversity within the business community, and that for some governments who are so used to just hearing repeatedly from the fossil fuel industry, when we start to see diversity in the business community, we start to see the evolution that needs to happen. It becomes inconvenient for those governments. And what we're asking for here, it's about regulations, it's about UNEP taking action to address conflict of interest, but it's also shining a light on this problem, the fact that it's happening for these governments at the national level as well. So when they send their delegations here, they have instructions to represent the will of the people, to represent the diversity within the business community that I think Martin represents, and that the Business Coalition for a Strong Plastics Treaty represents. So it's an important point. And again, I think the fossil fuel industry, petrochemical sector, stands out uniquely as a problematic force in the negotiations.
If I can put on my science hat and speak about recycling and how that might be addressed within this treaty space. So in my own research, we've looked at chemicals and recycled plastics, and we're finding hundreds and hundreds of chemicals that are not safe to be in products. And part of that is due to the way that plastics are being produced and products are being produced in today's societies. And if we're going to recycle, and recycling is on the table as part of the solution to this problem, then we need to move all the way upstream and change the way that we're designing and producing plastics and products. And part of this has to do with chemical simplification, reducing the numbers of chemicals that are used in plastics. Right now, that number is at 16,000 from a new PlastChem report that came out a few weeks ago. More than 4,000 of those are toxic. We also have very complex materials that are being produced and products, which multi-layers, and they're difficult to separate and sort and to recycle. So if we're going to do that in any way that is safe safer and more sustainable. We need to look upstream and call on producers to make products that can be recycled and that are safer to do so, and also require that they're revealing what they're putting into the products. So again, coming back to transparency and reporting. So just to have that said in this space, important things here too, upstream measures.
Yeah. All right. It does look like we actually have time for one more. So I'm going to take this here.
Hi, I'm Christian Louis Jensen from Ravia Films. We make documentaries. And I wonder, because there would be a lot of ways to disrupt negotiations besides direct influences. And I wonder if there's any science looking into disrupting connectivity, internet issues, sort of technical things. It would be very nice to see some statistics, because some of the things happening in the negotiations room, excuse my Leyland's language, but it's suspicious as fuck.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can say that I've had 3 attempts to access my computer just this morning.
Oh, wow. So there's my line up.
Yeah. I'm sure more while we're sitting here. So it's definitely an issue. Does anyone else want to comment and talk about connectivity or what's going on here?
Well, I'd say that one common thing to all INCs is Wi-Fi issues. And the Wi-Fi is so weak that it's really difficult to use a VPN. And when you don't use a VPN, you have phishing attempts. I'm not saying there is anything intentional there, but I'm just noting that this has been constant throughout all the INCs. And I don't think that anyone has resources to actually look into that, but that's definitely an interesting question to address.
Yeah. Yuyun?
I'd like to respond, but slightly different from different perspective. We also see a very prolific ad running around the city and also welcoming us at the airport with the messaging that saying this plastic saves life and so on and so on. So I don't know about the rules in Canada about that kind of ads, but I think it's worth to say and call that kind of advertisement is not ethical in this kind of negotiation time, because we know it's not true. There are lots of research findings and evidence that plastics also harmful to our life and not really saving us, but poisoning us. So I just want to put it there that the adverts and the rules of, how do you call it? It's like with tobacco campaign, right? It's unethical. So.
Absolutely. We're now out of time, but I want to thank all of our panelists for being here. I want to thank you all for joining us today and for folks who are watching the stream. If you want additional interviews with any of these folks or other organizations involved, please do reach out to me. I'm available at press@cl.org. And thank you again. We'll talk soon.
This was a Plastisphere guest episode. You've heard the press conference of the Center for International Environmental Law, CIEL, that took place during the fourth round of negotiations for the Global Plastics Treaty in Ottawa, Canada, on April 24. Ottawa is built on the unceded and unsurrendered territory of the peoples of the Algonquin Anishinaabe Nation, who have lived on this territory for millennia. Thanks to CIEL for sharing this recording with Plastisphere. CIEL's analysis of lobby attendance at INC4 was carried out in collaboration with Greenpeace, the Break Free from Plastic Movement, the International Pollutants Elimination Network, IPEN, the Global Alliance for Incinerator Alternatives, GAIA, the Environmental Investigation Agency, EIA, and the Global Center for Good Governance in Tobacco Control, GGTC. Find the link to the study in the show notes of this episode. The analysis is based on UNEP's provisional list of INC4 participants and likely an underestimate, as it only considered attendants who disclosed their connections to the fossil and plastics producing industry. Thanks to all speakers for their presence. Now, how will the story of the plastics treaty negotiations continue? Will the states step up despite the lobbying and really put an end to plastic pollution? I'll keep you updated.